You're listening to Angel Insights, brought to you by Syndicate Room. And for all new listeners to the show, this is the podcast that takes you inside the world of angel investing to reveal the tips, tactics, and strategies of some of the world's best angels and how they approach startup investing. And I'm thrilled to welcome an incredible angel to the show today in the form of Simon Thorpe. Now, Simon is a prolific angel with over 20 companies in his portfolio, achieving 4 exits to date, and I'm sure we'll see many more in the coming years, with the most notable being the recent SwiftKey exit to Microsoft. And for all TechCrunch readers, he's also an investor in DukeDeck, which won TechCrunch Startup Battlefield competition in London this year. And if that wasn't enough, Simon is also a mentor at Manchester University and Cambridge's Judge Business School Accelerate program. However, enough from me. So without further ado, I'm thrilled to welcome Simon Thorpe to the show today. Well, Simon, welcome to Angel Insights. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Great pleasure to be on.
Now, I'd love to kick off today by hearing a little about you and how you made your way into the world of angel investing.
So, well, of course, I'm not very interesting. I mean, what is perhaps some of the themes that's going to be much more interesting than me. But I've always been interested in technology, having been an investor and having been a stockbroker for many years. Researching companies. So I was actually started off, believe it or not, doing a business finance and economics degree. I then studied accountancy. It was very boring. I knew it was going to be very boring, but I did it in order to become a business person, become an entrepreneur, because I actually thought I wanted to set up my own business. And in essence, I became an entrepreneur in a very big investment bank, which is where I worked for 22 years. And in all that time, I was researching companies. And that's really how I got interested in technology in a big way, because international investors wanted tomorrow's growth stories. And in small caps, that's where the growth stories were. That's how I got involved in technology. And that's how I really moved on to angel investing.
And then moving to your angel investing, you've had 4 exits in the past 12 months, which is, I think, a first for me ever on a show. That has to be one of the best records I've had. So I'd love to hear how that success then changes your mindset when it comes to viewing startups and how it alters that for you.
All of these things, there's a certain amount of good fortune involved. Investments or exits, if you like, are very much like London buses. Nothing happens for a period of time and then they all come at once. So there is an element of that. But there's also, you know, joking apart, most of the companies that that I've invested in that have exited in the last 12 months have I invested in back in 2009, 2010. So, you know, you're looking at a 6 or 7 year time frame between investment and exit. And I think many people forget that. When you go and see everybody's business plan, they all say we're going to exit in 3 years. Maybe they say 3 to 5 years. But the reality is you've got to be a longer-term investor than that.
Mm-hmm. And do you find that feedback loop quite hard then, not knowing whether it's a success or not, and having very little information really to go on other than future funding rounds?
Well, some companies are much better than others at actually keeping their investors in touch along the way. The best companies manage their investors' expectations effectively. They keep them in touch regularly. And if there are problems, they make sure their shareholders are aware of the problems and why there are problems. One of the most difficult things, I mean, bear in mind, so I've had some exits. I've also had some failures. And what you need to try and do is to try and, if you like, make sure the failures actually do fail properly. And you make a conscious decision that either the company goes bust, in which case that usually it happens itself. The slightly more difficult ones are where they're still soldiering on under the impression they're still going to be a huge success when it's pretty clear to everybody that they're not going to be. And those are the ones where you actually have to move on. It's a bit like managing a team. You've got to spend your time with the good ones and not spend all of your time getting dragged down by the bad ones.
So at that stage, what do you do with those entrepreneurs? Do you try to as kindly let them down as possible, or do you let them soldier on and just kind of support your winners?
The ones that are clearly failing, it usually becomes pretty clear, and it becomes pretty clear to the founders that they're going to fail. Hopefully they will come to that decision themselves, maybe influenced by you and other investors, but hopefully they'll come to that decision themselves. The more difficult ones actually are the ones in the middle of your portfolio. So you have some successes at one end, you have some failures at the other end. And in my case, I'm fortunate that my successes are more than paid for my failures. And I've still got quite a significant portfolio of companies. But the ones in the middle are the difficult ones. So they're the ones where the founders have done pretty much what they said they would do. Their business plan is pretty much what they said it was going to be at the beginning. They've taken on a number of investment rounds, and at each point, there's never really been a reason why you would say, I can't invest in this company because they've done something completely different from what they've said they do, or the marketplace has completely changed, or their technology's become completely redundant. If none of those things have happened, it's actually very difficult to say, right, I'm going to cut this now and I'm going to stop investing. Mm-hmm. Those are the tricky ones.
So what do you do in that situation?
Well, I think at some point you get to a point where you might say, well, I'm no longer going to follow my money. So when you're on to the fifth round, you know, you've had an investment round every year for 5 years. You have to ask yourself, is this ever actually going to see an exit and achieve some sort of sensible return?
Do you not get concerned that if you follow on for five rounds and then for the sixth round, say you don't follow on, there's a kind of signaling to the other investors in the community who maybe are following on that? Do you see what I mean? The negative signaling effect.
I understand exactly what you mean, but that depends on where you are as an investor. So if you're the lead or cornerstone investor, then clearly that's a problem. That has a significant impact. Fortunately, most of the investments I'm in, I'm not the cornerstone investor. I'm not big enough to be the cornerstone investor, and I'm one of a number of angel investors. Mm-hmm. So that you don't have that signaling problem. But you know, clearly, if you're in the management team, or if you're more likely, you're an executive, non-executive on the board, or you're an observer to the board, then you're likely to have a more influential position. And therefore, you're absolutely right. That signal you send is going to be important.
And I'm intrigued that you said, obviously, you've had successes and failures. What are the reasons then, most common reasons, that startups do fail in your cases?
Well, let's start with the successes, first of all. Why have the successes occurred? In my case, if I look at the strong themes, then usually they are two founders. And those two founders have highly complementary skills. So generally, one will be the CTO and will be the technical person, and one will be the commercial stroke marketing person. And that's the ideal combination. It doesn't always follow that, but that's the first thing. The second thing is they've got to have a very clear piece of technology, a clear idea, and it's got to be a good solution for a well-known market problem. So if I take SwiftKey as an example, an obvious example, two guys, highly complementary skills, they came to me and others with a prototype. It was very clear what that prototype was about, i.e. it was predictive text for touchscreen devices. Anybody could see what that meant. Now, of course, lots of people said to me, how did I see that was going to be a success? Well, it was a judgment. I didn't know it was going to be a success. It took 6 years for the business to be sold to Microsoft. That's a good example of success. What else did I look for in a successful team or successful exit? They had a very big market they were addressing. You know, the number
entire of, mobile market, essentially.
Absolutely. It was a global market. It was huge. We could see right from the early stage that there was huge scale potential. So those are some of the things I look for in successes. Interestingly, in all my exits, I've been a passive investor, not an active investor. Now, most angel investors will tell you that they like to be an active investor, but many people mistake being an active investor with meddling, partly because they've been an entrepreneur themselves before, or they've run a business like that before, and so they want to meddle. So there's a subtle difference there. Now, I'm not saying that active management or active angel investment is not a good thing to do. It clearly is. I'm just saying that actually, in my case, my four exits, I've been a passive investor.
And so what involvement do you like then? Is that involvement when requested or when asked for? How much of a role do you like to play then as a passive investor? Is that purely a silent angel?
So I think it varies enormously. So I'm not saying when I'm a passive investor, I'm not doing anything. I like to make myself available such that if the founders want to call me about a particular issue, they think I can add some value, then I'm there for them. You know, they can ring me. They can get a hold of me by telephone. That's quite important, or Skype or whatever it is. But there will be a place where a more active role, i.e. as an observer or as a non-executive or possibly even some form of consultant, but that's less likely. more likely that I'm some form of mentor or coach in the background, or an introducer to relevant contexts.
And we spoke about the market there for SwiftKey, and when kind of addressing markets, we always hear it's a hard dichotomy, because you get some investors who go for the $1 billion markets that can return the fund, and then others go for kind of niches and verticals that you can go after highly specialized. So when you have a market like SwiftKey's, which is so broad, how do you address that and look at that?
One other point around SwiftKey is when they started, SwiftKey was very much about, as I said, predictive text for touchscreen devices. But actually now it's regarded as one of the UK's leading artificial intelligence plays. So if you like, the reason why I'm rationalizing, the reason why they bought SwiftKey was because they recognize how important artificial intelligence is.
Yeah.
And they recognize that SwiftKey's engineering team and SwiftKey's personnel and their founders could actually help them develop their own artificial intelligence skills. And you've seen that, you know, artificial intelligence is clearly now a very, very important subsector of tech. And you've seen a number of US companies buy a number of UK companies, you know, DeepMind being one, VocalIQ being another, SwiftKey being another.
And then with regards to the deals themselves, I was speaking to an angel the other day, and he was saying that whatever you do, you always have to do the same size check in each investment, because at such an early stage, you can't really predict which one of your portfolio will do it. If you do, then it's negative signaling and it's just rogue. So do the same, he said to me. Basically, this was his advice to me. Do you agree with that? Help me out here, Simon.
I mean, I think that's logical. That's entirely logical. And of course, if you were looking at portfolio theory, that's exactly what you should do. Initially, you would probably, if you were starting to build a portfolio, you'd probably want to try and build 10 stakes in 10 different companies. And yes, logically, they should be the same size. Practice, that doesn't work like that. Often, you won't necessarily have the choice of making a particular investment amount. You know, you may be able to be in a round that just simply because somebody else has introduced you at the last moment, and there may be a certain amount left on the table. It may be that you are cornerstoning a round, in which case you are expected to take a much larger amount. So I think you have to be pragmatic about it.
And then if cornerstoning, do you ever have a maximum that you're willing to allocate in terms of like 20% of the round is the max that you, Simon, will do? Or will you do more than that?
Well, I actually did cornerstone a round recently on the Syndicate Room platform, which is a company called Numi, very exciting company run by two very bright guys with a maths heritage. And in that case, it was a CDIS round. I cornerstoned it with 50K, and there was a further 100K raise. So, you know, effectively, I did a third of the round. And but that will depend on the circumstances.
And talking of EIS and SEIS, how do you find the investing environment in the UK, do you think? Do you think the UK, you know, as you said, we've had a lot of talent being bought by US companies. Are you very bullish on the UK market as a whole?
Has EIS and CEIS been successful in the UK? Yes, definitely. You know, if you talk to the Americans, as you do, you will know that they regard the tax incentives in the UK, you know, with envy, because we do have a very clear structure of incentivizing startups. And I think that's worked very well. I do think, though, what we're not so good at is what Sherry Kuti talks about, is scale-ups. You know, so in other words, you know, you could say something like SwiftKey, why didn't the UK scale that company? Why has an American company bought it? Well, you know, the answer is we're not actually so good at taking companies on to the next stage, having started them up and having proved they're very successful.
Do you not agree there's quite a narrow exit funnel, though, for European startups? If you look at the market realistically from a macro perspective, are there that many billion-dollar acquirers in Europe?
I do agree. I mean, I think that's the issue. I mean, the natural buyer tends to be a US company. Mm-hmm. You know, and that's been true of my exits. You know, they've all been to US companies.
And then flipping the side of the coin, we spoke about the successes. If we then talk about maybe the ones that haven't worked out so well, are there any commonalities you've seen in those that haven't and why they haven't?
Yeah, so thanks for bringing me back to that, because I think it's good to get the balance between the successes and the failures. I think on the failures, first of all, the things that have failed for me have not been in the digital world. And I think if you look at my investments, they've pretty well all been in the digital world. The only ones that haven't have not worked. Now, so there's quite a strong message in that. You know, maybe that's my own expertise, or maybe it's actually the fact that the growth opportunity is much better in the digital world. You know, I'm sure you've heard me talk about the digital revolution is the next industrial revolution. And I genuinely believe that. You know, some people call it the fourth revolution. You know, this is a massive change. Companies who get digital will likely profit from it. Those who don't and who don't apply today's technologies will get left behind. It's as simple as that. What, you know, what else can I learn from my failures? Sometimes the management team isn't as good as I thought they were at the beginning. Sometimes I have one example where the product was absolutely fantastic, but the competition was just too strong, and the competition were effectively able to give their product away in order to subsidize other businesses, and that effectively killed our business. So those are some of the key things. And big execution risk. You know, I think that often there are companies that they have a great idea, they think it's all about the idea, but actually they're then not capable of executing the business plan. Mm-hmm. They're not capable of growing the management team that's required to deliver on the growth plan that they had at the beginning.
And I come across a lot of startups that prioritize growth over revenue in that hard balance. Where do you lie on the relationship between growth and revenue, particularly in today's market where unit economics are being very much focused on by VCs and investors?
In the old days, you would grow your you would grow revenue. You'd be profitable very quickly, and you would reinvest your cash in developing the business. You'd grow organically. Of course, people spotted that you could grow much faster if you use somebody else's money to accelerate your growth. And hence, you know, why we've got everywhere you look, you've now got an accelerator. And so it's a question of the speed to market. You know, the Americans have been very smart at recognizing that if they grow enough users without any revenue at all, eventually they'll get such a strong monopoly position
that they will cash that.
Then the revenue comes, and then the cash comes, and you can reinvest the cash. And you know, there's so many good. You know, you look at Google, Facebook, Amazon. That's what these companies are doing, and they've got incredibly strong market positions globally.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned accelerators there. Before we dive into the quickfire round, I just want to hear about how you like to look at accelerators, and do you like to work with accelerators, invest in accelerator companies? Often they're described as having overinflated valuations because they've been to a premium accelerator. Do you find that?
Well, I think there are a wide range of accelerators. One of the accelerators I know best is the Cambridge Just Business Schools Accelerate Program, which is exceptionally good. And that's partly because of the people behind it and the mentors and the coaches that give their time and behind it. But I think there's probably an interesting analogy around crowdfunding platforms, because there's a room for crowdfunding platforms. There's certainly a room for Syndicate Room, which isn't a vanilla crowdfunding platform. It's obviously, as you know, based on retail
diligence.
You have to get the same terms as somebody like me who's seen as an experienced angel investor. So it is different, and an important difference. But the crowdfunding can achieve a much higher valuation for the company than is deserved. And that's really because the power is with the company raising the money rather than the investors that are investing. And ultimately, that's bad news for the company, because the company will almost certainly raise money at the completely the wrong valuation at some point later in that company's career. It has to then have a down round, because once it gets to a more serious investment round, it won't be able to raise it on the right terms.
Mm-hmm. And I'd love to dive into a quickfire round with you now.
Well, let's go ahead.
Let's go for it. Okay, so the best piece of advice ever given to you?
Well, I've been given lots of pieces of advice. I think that the most important thing is to learn quickly from your mistakes.
Okay, absolutely. And then underhyped and overhyped sectors. Are there any that particularly strike you in either of those cases?
Well, right now, I probably have to say that suddenly artificial intelligence has got rather overhyped. Mm-hmm. Now, that's not to say that it isn't a really important domain. It is. And we're going to see a lot more of that. But suddenly from, you didn't really hear artificial intelligence talked about that much a year ago.
No, now it's all. Now it's AI for everything. AI, I saw AI for laundry the other day. I don't get how it works personally, but yeah. And then underhyped.
Well, we've been talking about this a lot this week. I mean, blockchain potentially underhyped. Obviously, Bitcoin is an example of blockchain, but of the principle of blockchain. The reason I say blockchain is probably underhyped is because actually it's lacking. Very few people actually understand it. There isn't there isn't a legal framework at all around it. So it's totally unregulated. Bitcoin itself is known as the currency of the black market, but who knows where that goes? And many of the big financial institutions are having to think about how they deal with blockchain and with Bitcoin. And they're dealing in a exclusively regulated environment, and then they're looking at this concept which is totally unregulated and thinking, how on earth do we deal with this?
Yeah, absolutely. And then your favorite startup blog or investing newsletter? Or
Numi do quite an interesting blog, of course.
Okay.
But that's that platform allows you to look at all sorts of different topics. So it does allow you to look at technology, but not exclusively technology. I look at Benedict Evans' material. I use Twitter a lot to access, and there's all sorts of interesting information available through Twitter if you know where to look. Mm-hmm. You have to spend a bit of time looking for it and searching for it.
So do you curate your followers list to the people you follow, so you get a highly tailored news feed, not full of jargon, to be honest with you?
Well, I'd like to think so, but it is quite difficult because there's a lot of noise. And I think I'm following over 1,000 people, so that means you've got quite a lot in your timeline.
Yeah, absolutely.
So you need to search. But I know, I probably have about 10 people that I will regularly look at to see what they're tweeting about, and that usually adds value.
Okay, absolutely. And then I would like to dive into your most recent investment and why you said yes. Let's end on that one.
All right. Good question. My most recent. Why I said yes? Because it had a very defined piece of technology, which I thought would have significant commercial application. And the reason I thought it had significant commercial application was because it was going to allow a significant cost saving on the technology that's out there at the moment.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I just have to latch onto one thing there. When you say talk about the technology in that way, is this really, really strong, cohesive brand enough without IP for a startup to have? You know, we see a lot of startups now that say, our branding's so strong, we don't need the IP. Do you subscribe to that, or is that a worrying thing for you?
I think IP is a very interesting discussion in itself. I'm actually invested in a company called Ingot, as in the gold bar, which is a software tool to allow you to classify and value your IP. I think IP is poorly understood, and I think IP, for me personally as an investor, is very, very important. That doesn't necessarily mean, if you're looking at a software company, it doesn't mean patenting software, because that's genuinely very difficult. Some people do it, but it's very difficult. You can spend a lot of money and waste a lot of money on IP. But every company has to have an IP strategy. And that's not just patents, it's trademarks, copyrights. It's the whole thinking about actually how they can create value with their IP.
Mm-hmm. Well, Simon, thank you so much for joining me today. I really have loved chatting with you, and it's been amazing to hear your journey.
Well, Harry, I hope that's been interesting.
Interesting indeed, and I'd like to say a huge thank you to Simon for giving up his time today to be on the show. Also, if you'd like to find the article that accompanies today's show, then you can find it on syndicateroom.com under the Learning Academy section. And also, we'd love it if you would follow us on Twitter at syndicateroom. That way you'll never miss an update or an episode from us. Before we leave, we have to remind you that early stage investing is risky. Therefore, please ensure that you engage in the proper due diligence prior to making the investment. And as always, we're so grateful for your continued support, and we look very forward to bringing you next week's episode.